I became quickly concerned about the awareness of persons going to the WVU hospital and being arrested for drug use in the process of seeking help due to the hospital notifying law enforcement of the fact that there was a drug user that was present. I had arrived in Morgantown in the fall of 1968 to serve as an associate campus minister with the Westminster Foundation of the United Presbyterian Church denomination. In the spring of 1969, Charles Snork Roberts, who I
All
hope that
right.
many of you know or have known, the Episcopal campus minister, and I decided that we would convene a meeting to discuss the situation at the hospital with the prosecuting attorney, the sheriff, the Morgantown chief of police, plus representatives from the WVU School of Pharmacy, Psychiatry, WVU Hospital Administration, and several informed students. This all to take place at the Campus Ministry Center, which at that time was located on Oakland Street. We had a full attendance of the invited guests at that meeting. The results of the discussion were that the hospital would stop notifying the police when persons came to the hospital for help. Secondly, the police would stop arresting people seeking help. And thirdly, the students would help organize peer counseling for persons in drug crisis. And Snork and I helped organize a council for drug information, which had a volunteer 24-hour telephone access service based in Newman Hall. Just as you go in the door, Newman Hall, where students in need of help could call day or night, 24/7. And that went on for a couple of years. When we realized that the 296 drug number was being mostly used by students, we set up an information referral and crisis service line at the WC of CTU building, run by a new organization, which we called the Community Need Council. The drug council service continued until the drug scene changed to barbiturates and amphetamines. And of course, these kinds of drugs were beyond the capabilities of a peer counseling response. And so we discontinued that service immediately. The 296 need phone line first set up in 1970, was covered around the clock, first by trained volunteers and later by staff who were former volunteers and were trained and savvy about the types of calls we were receiving. The service continued to operate the need council or need line for almost 5 years and was discontinued due to lack of funding. The In Touch and Concern telephone reassurance and transportation escort service was designed for the elderly and first supported by a grant which we received from the West Virginia Commission on Aging. In Touch and Concern was a spin-off, therefore, from the Need Council. And we were hoping that some of that funding could be used to so support the Need Council, but it did not work out. But the In Touch and Concern lasted from 1972 to 2017. And it fell principally because of lack of funding. I worked out of town in Fairmont and then Cumberland for 25 years, from the year 1973 until I retired in 1968. In 2000, I did a 3,400 mile bike ride across the country with the American Lung Association from Seattle to DC, and was inspired by many of the towns that we visited. I kept asking myself, why can't we do this in Morgantown? The first thing I did when I got back to Morgantown was to team up with a group of individuals who were concerned about the Department of Highway plans to build a bypass around Morgantown. From my travels, I knew that a bypass, which would be a mistaken first priority. A circular bypass around a community creates a donut, a big hole with a big hole in the middle. New investments should be constructed, a lot would be constructed along the bypass and compete with those which already had been established in the middle, without the people in the middle having the advantages of new roads and parking and what have you. The central city, in effect, rots in the middle of a donut hole. Economically and socially, a pedestrian infrastructure remains a low priority. We called our committee the First Things First Committee. Our emphasis was to improve from the inside out. We met weekly at the Lutheran Church basement and fought against the bypass and for internal road improvements valiantly. The bypass did not happen, but little else happened. Our five priorities were upgrading the Green Bag Road as an internal ring road with good intersections at both ends, et cetera, widening the Mile Ground, upgrading and widening Beechhurst, widening and upgrading the main road in Saberton, and finishing the Star City Bridge, which at that time was kind of in sleepland as far as being completed was concerned. The last two were accomplished, but with a reduction in the designs that our committee was hoping for. The Mile Ground, of course, has just been renovated this past year. Beechhurst will be completed in some form this year, 20 years after First Things First worked so hard advocating for these improvements. Each will be the kind of enhancement which should strengthen city growth before bypass construction. The First Things First had some excellent support in signed petitions supporting this campaign. Even Mike Pushkar, president of Mylan Pharmaceuticals, and most of the city business people understood the need for fix up of the interior roads before engaging in a sprawl generating road on the outside of the community. The second thing that I did after my reawakening bike trip across the country was to run for city council. One of the first things I learned on city council was that some of the members had acquired funds for their campaigns from just one or two persons. In my first campaign, I accepted $100 contributions from a few persons. But I realized quickly that those larger contributions impacted my perspective on various issues. I explored municipal campaign finance reform options and learned that the ACLU promoted the use of small donations for campaigns of various magnitude. And so, for my second campaign, I limited the size of contributions that I would accept to $10. I did so for each of the remaining seven campaigns that I conducted for city council. It was better for me and for the process. The word got around, but none of my fellow counselors expressed a willingness to support a campaign reform for the city. I would later learn better why. Another thing that I learned early was that there were many items that the city council couldn't even address because of state code restrictions. I made a list in 2006, that was 3 years after I'd been on council, and had 34 topics that the Morgantown City Council could not address because of state policy. 34 items in 3 years. which means that the state code not specifically allow a committee to do something, or the Dillon's rule is the factor that created that kind of mindset in many states. And the lack of the Dillon's rule was saying that if it's not specifically permissible in a state, then it's not permitted. Some of the items included restricting the use of ticketing to only the police. That meant that the issuance of ticketing for littering, mishandling of trash, most parking infractions were never addressed. With the support of council, I brought two bills to the legislature on each of these items, and with the support of friendly legislators in both houses, and the support of the Municipal League, we got both bills passed. The most important legislature we succeeded in getting passed happened in 2006 and 2007. In attending a Municipal League meeting in Chester, West Virginia, that's the town at the northern tip of the state, I worked on a position paper on home rule for cities with Jim Hunt, who was attending the meeting, Jim Hunt from Clarksburg, and then some other city councilors from other communities. Before leaving the committee of the meeting, I had drafted a two-page position paper for a pilot home rule, which became the substance for a resolution passed by the Morgantown City Council calling for the state legislature to pass a pilot home rule bill. The title of the paper was Home Rule in West Virginia Cities. With the support of Senator Ed Bowman of Weirton and Delegate Barbara Fleshour from Morgantown, of course, as well as the Municipal League, we got the bill passed just before midnight, the midnight closing of the 2007 session. I spent 10 days in Charleston helping to generate support for that legislation. A legislative joint committee mulled over the implications of that bill being passed and decided that only projects approved by the committee would be acceptable for home rule. It proved to be an important beginning and a means for addressing the Dillon's rule rulings. Several cities made requests and they were approved. The state stranglehold on city policy formulation began loosening up. Morgantown in 2010 had 15,822 registered voters. During the first four elections in the first decade of the 21st century, the average Morgantown voter turnout was 9%. The council joined the citizens in being concerned about the low voter participation and began exploring the viability of the vote by mail system. which had been established in Oregon and was working very effectively there, and went to other states as well. They reported increasing participation by 10 to 20%. Morgantown passed a resolution supporting state approval of a vote-by-mail program. With lots of advocacy at the state legislature, the pilot program was approved. Morgantown was selected to be one of the pilot cities, and as a result of this first election, the increase of voter turnout increased not just 10 to 20%, but by over 100%. Instead of the 9% turnout, which Morgantown had been averaging, the percent of registered voters voting in the 2011 election was 22%. And there are several benefits, which I won't take the time to go in detail unless there are questions on that. Much of the access that I had in Charleston with legislation was built on the support of the Municipal League and local legislators. But it also helped that I had the title Deputy Mayor, indicating that I had been designated by my city council for leadership. Other factors were my use of city resolutions on all issues that we brought before the state, and brief position papers. I usually did not go to the legislature without having done basic homework and having brief, succinct copies of papers on issues, which I could leave with all after talking with them. I did not conduct any meeting of city council here in Morgantown without having talked with the city manager and sometimes other staff to know what the context was on each issue. I provided leadership for the establishment of 9 additional boards, commissions, and committees in the city government so that there would be better public input on key issues as well as better implementation of changes when improvements were possible. I wrote 33 papers on best practices relating to issues the council addressed. I brought forward 17 resolutions and several amendments to ordinances to the city council, all of which were adopted. I provided staff work for committees or commissions when funds were not available to support such services. These projects included researching and preparing a 100-page pedestrian safety plan, writing six successful grant applications benefiting Dorsey's Knob Park, drafting backup assistance of the city attorney, a diversity, equity, and inclusion plan for the city, which was adopted in 2000, developed a handbook for city neighborhood associations, organized orientation materials on new city, oh, for the new city, for a new city manager. City manager comes in cold, doesn't really have a way of understanding what's going on unless someone helps them do that. Drafting guidelines for multiple commissions and committees, drafting an eight-page orientation on the Human Rights Commission, making multiple unreimbursed trips to Charleston, and one even to Boston to support critical action on legislative changes benefiting the city, and more. Even with all the care, I naively made at least one major critical misjudgment. After being on the council 3 years and repeating the Pledge of Allegiance for multiple times each year, I became disenchanted with the pledge as it was written in 1892, and stopped saying it. It had not been updated. There was no mention of equality in the pledge, because in 1892, there was no equality for women, no equality for persons of color, no viable equality for persons of color, the Jim Crow laws, etc. Persons with disability, diverse sexuality, gender identity, Native Americans. There's no mention of caring for the natural world or the climates upon which we depend. The words "under God" had been added when I was in high school. And at that time, it was recognized that those were non-inclusive words, because some people did not believe in God and had or else had other religious understandings. And it was also considered a movement in the 1950s to be anti-communist. It was also considered to be exploitive political addition. All this was added with this "under God" when I was in high school during the early 1950s. And so I stopped saying the pledge for 5 years. But my opponents noticed. And in February of 2011, on the first official day of the 2011 campaign, they attacked my lack of patriotism. All of a sudden, people were saying that I didn't believe in God, even though I was an ordained minister, clergy person, and that I must be a communist sympathizer, and that the radio and their radio ads throughout each day directing insinuations about my lack of trustworthiness and lack of appropriate citizenship. I'd already developed a pledge, an alternative pledge of allegiance, and that had gone to newspapers in Morgantown, Charleston, and Washington, D.C. And the one that I called was a pledge of allegiance for the 21st century. And that pledge was as follows. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Democratic Republic for which it stands, working toward an inclusive nation on a shared and cared for planet with civil liberty, equal rights, and justice for all. Other members of council were powerless to give support to me for fear of being linked with the criticism that I was receiving. There were many residents who understood that most of the negativity was being supported on radio ads, what have you, by an apparent singular unlimited supply of funds. They turned out and voted in support of my candidacy. But when the votes were counted, I was 100 votes short from being reelected. The opposition also went after the mayor, Bill Byrne, but he had several thousands of dollars that he could put into radio ads to help squeak by the assault. I did not have such resources from my campaign and to do any kind of a pushback. The meager resources from my fundraising were obviously insufficient.
Hey, Tom, we probably should stop there because we've got some business we need to handle. Other questions for Don? Thank you.
Okay.
I have a question. It's not for Don directly, but I mean, I was deeply moved by the entire presentation and hope we can find some way of preserving it, whether it becomes part of something perhaps in the WVU libraries or the, but this is a document of extreme importance to the history of our city, not just Don's life history. So I don't know that we can do that at this meeting, but I think this is a very important document to be well preserved as part of the city's history.
We are recording it. I did remember to hit the record button, so it'll be on our website. Don, if you could go back a little bit before you came to Morgantown, I think you were at the March on Washington in 1963.
Yes.
Well, could you talk?
63? No, I was not. I was
oh,
not.
Okay.
I was in teaching in Massachusetts at that time, and I was not able to work that out. I was just finishing graduate student school, and I did not make that trip at that time.
Okay, I didn't know if you'd been involved in any of the civil rights movements before you came to Morgantown, but I guess Morgantown got you started.
Well, I had obviously had been involved individually and also in the school that I was working at, and also a little bit in Springfield, which was adjacent to the community where the school was located. And I also had the honor of being at a presentation by Dr. Martin Luther King and his riding on in the bus that I was riding on for going over to the cemetery where he was the primary speaker. So I've had lots of different odds and ends that I've done, but in Morgantown, I tried to limit my focus to just Morgantown for this presentation. But civil rights has not been a primary attention for me.
I know Eve wants to include you in the exhibit that she's working on, and she mentioned the bus ride, and I wasn't real clear where that had been.
That was in Washington, D.C., and it was part of the anti-war efforts. And Dr. King had spoken with a couple of other speakers at a large church in downtown Washington, and then went over to the Arlington Cemetery for a special event. And he happened to be riding on the bus. It sat a couple seats ahead of me on the bus. And I did not really have an opportunity to talk with him individually, so I never really met him. But it was a privilege to be part of that day with him. And it's been obviously influential for me in every Martin Luther King holiday time. I recall those precious moments that were influential in my life.
Thank you. Anybody else?
We should also say that Don and I worked, but with a lot of leadership from Don, on getting the city's Human Rights Commission revitalized a couple of years ago. And that took a lot of work and real. The vision for that came from Don.
I have that in my last Information, pages of information that I have here. And I'd be very happy to share copies of this with anyone who is interested. In fact, I'd love to have it if, Mike, if you'd be willing to authorize the distribution, I'd be happy to pass this along to Sheila or anyone else that could facilitate the distribution to those of you who are present tonight.
I could put a copy on the website for people to get a hold of as a PDF.
That would be great. I would definitely love a copy.
Okay.
And great. Maybe put it in the West Virginian Regional History Center, Don. We can talk about that later.
Okay.